This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In recent weeks, many of us have been glued to the news as protests against excessive use of police force against Black Americans have spread all over the country. The journalists reporting that news have been working hard. For Black journalists, the demands have been both professional and very personal. They're covering the deaths of people who look like themselves, members of their family. We wanted to take a few moments to consider how this work is being done and really who's doing it. Kat Stafford reports national stories on race and ethnicity for the Associated Press. Kat, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me back on.
Ken Coleman is a writer for Michigan Advance and the author of books such as Soul on Air, Blacks Who Helped Define Radio in Detroit. Ken Coleman, good to have you back too.
Good day. Thanks for having me.
Can I ask both of you, of all the news that we were seeing through the weekend, what struck you the most?
Well, there's no doubt. What's been extremely surprising, at least for this journalist who's been doing this stuff for 30 years, is the number of protests, not only in the city of Detroit proper, but they have now expanded to outer ring suburbs. They are, in large part, majority white. And that's something that I did not see 27 years ago when I was covering the Malice Green murder trial in Detroit. And so, you know, what I've seen in my lifetime compared to what I've seen over the last 10 days has been phenomenal.
Yeah. Kat, how about you?
I guess for me, seeing what I see as a culmination of many different things coming to head all at once. You're seeing the impact of COVID-19 on Black communities happening. You're seeing the economic fallout happening. And now we're dealing with the police brutality. But also what really caught my eye this weekend is this almost kind of reckoning that's happening within our own industry in terms of journalism. And a lot of people really saying, you know, Black journalists have been calling out these issues for years, for decades, and now people are finally listening to us. Finally, you're hearing our voices break through the ceiling that's been in place for so long, and there's so much frustration. So for me, I've been really watching all of that unfold because really this is part of what's happening right now. You have to take a hard look at our coverage and how we have covered policing in Black communities over the years, how we've covered health disparities over the years in Black communities. All of that frustration is bubbling up right now. And that's what I've been paying attention to.
There was a survey from the Pew Research Center a couple years ago that found more than 75% of newsroom staff across America, 75% are white. How do you see that shaping the coverage of, I mean, I want to say things like the death of George Floyd, but also just the many ingredients in this perfect storm we're seeing right now. Kat, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I say this all the time, and I'm sure, you know, Ken has a lot of experience in this as well. I'm not shocked to see that people are feeling the way they feel right now, because when you have newsrooms that don't have not just diversity, I've kind of pushed back on that phrase. I prefer to call it representation, because that's what you really want to see in terms of who is in the newsrooms, who are making these decisions around coverage. When you don't have that representation, you are going to see stories that do not accurately represent what's happening in the moment. So when COVID-19 first started happening, when it became clear that Black people were being disproportionately impacted, so many of the stories, the coverage, were blaming these core morbidities instead of looking at how systemic racism and structural racism really led us to this point where Black folks are more likely to live in areas impacted by pollution, why Black people are more likely to live in food deserts, right? So when we look at this now police brutality issue, it's not surprising to see that there's so much anger directed toward the media, because we just have not been in these communities the way that we should have been.
One of the things that kind of surprised me over the weekend was there are a couple of stories across the nation in which Black journalists have been asked to step off the protest beat. Ken, what are we saying when we imply that Black journalists can't cover what's going on right now truthfully?
It's crazy. It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my life. And we live in a time where, you know, the most ridiculous thing that you've seen in your life changes every day. But look it, as I pointed out a little bit earlier, I broke into the business in the early 90s. And I'm old enough to have been a reporter during the Rodney King beating in Los Angeles in the early 90s and the Malice Green fatal killing in Detroit in 1992. I remember being a rookie journalist in Detroit, and the National Association of Black Journalists were holding their national convention in Detroit. I vividly remember our souvenir booklet for the convention, and Gannett, that owned the Detroit News at the time, took out a back page, full color ad that had half column photos of the journalists, just the journalists that worked at the Detroit News. The half column photo took up the entire back color page of the souvenir booklet.
Oh, wow.
I've walked through the Detroit News and Detroit Free Press newsrooms in the last year, and not only have seen the dramatic reduction in the number of people who cover news, but disproportionately, it seems to me, the number of Black folk or people of color who are part of those news organizations. It's absolutely ridiculous to me for a news gathering agency of any semblance of respectability to omit or prevent an African-American journalist from covering what's going on today. It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my life, and I'm proud to work for a news site that values, as an African-American, values my point of view. What's going on in Pittsburgh, what happened at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is absolutely ridiculous to me.
For those who haven't seen the story, Alexis Johnson was the reporter at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette who was barred from protest coverage. But her cause was quickly picked up by journalists and others across the nation, suggesting that she was indeed, there was no one better to cover protests in her town. You know, it's great to hear that those conversations happen, but in newsrooms that aren't as diverse, you know, what's being asked of Black journalists if they are in mostly white environments and they're being asked to, you know, maybe take on a share of this that, you know, maybe puts them in typically dangerous positions? Kat, what do you see being asked of the African-American reporters that you know?
I'm glad that newsrooms are leaning on the expertise of Black reporters that do exist in these to be frank, white spaces, these white newsrooms. But I'm always cautious because I feel as if the onus should not solely be on the Black reporters, the Black staff in newsrooms to provide this perspective. At some point, at some level, our allies in the newsroom, other people in the newsroom are going to have to do the work and try to really immerse themselves in these communities to understand what's really happening, whether that's just working from, you know, I'm looking at Detroit specifically, working at Narrow Way for a day, you know, really going out and meeting people, not just for a story, but just connecting with the community. We have to rebuild the trust that has been damaged by decades of journalists that really didn't do due diligence when it came to making those connections. And I had a conversation with my dad, who has lived in Detroit his entire life. He was in Detroit during the 67 riots uprising, and he just turned 80 this year. And we were talking about the media coverage of George Floyd, the protests and everything. And from his perspective, he feels as if the media once again is doing the same thing. You know, he was in his 20s when the rebellion happened in Detroit, and he just recalls how the story he felt was not told from a Black perspective. It was told through a very narrow white gaze. And, you know, just hearing my dad share these thoughts, it concerns me, and I'm worried that we're making the same mistakes again. Just looking at how there's been so much focus on the looting as opposed to why are these people in the streets? Where is this anger and frustration coming from? Those are the stories that should be focused on right now, right? So I'm just concerned that we're going to continuously make these same mistakes that we've made over the years.
Kat, what kinds of things are you considering when you're choosing the words that you use to write stories about protests and unrest? You know, there's been a lot of discussion in recent days over whether it's appropriate to call the destruction of property violent, or indeed who might be responsible for that.
That's a great question. I mean, you see, I just corrected myself when I said 67 riots, because I think we have to be very careful with how we phrase things. So I've been very cautious in my, not just the language I'm using, but who are the voices that I am uplifting in my coverage right now. I had a story about Black women mayors who really in this moment are stepping up and leading some of these large cities that have had a lot of the protests that we're seeing across the country. And intentionality is what I'm trying to do, making sure the people that I am quoting have the expertise that can add an extra layer of nuance and understanding for readers. So for me, it's not even just the language that I use, but really who are the voices that are being amplified in this moment. That I can't think of anything that's more important than that when you're looking at COVID-19, when you're talking about police brutality.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kat Stafford. She reports national stories on race and ethnicity for the Associated Press. And we're also talking with Ken Coleman. He's a writer from Michigan Advance. They're both based in Detroit. Ken, I feel like you were one of the first observers in my feed covering the protests in Detroit, observing that nightside protesters looked different than the dayside group. Could you say a little bit more about that and why you felt it was important to that people see what you saw?
No, I appreciate it. I live in a town that's 80% Black, and I've lived in this town for 52 years. And one of the things that Detroiters always sort of joke about with each other is, I mean, we're a big city, but we're really sort of a big town. And everybody kind of knows everybody. The activist community, you know, I know who those people are. And so what was immediately striking to me the first day was both really in the daytime and nighttime protests was it didn't look like Detroit to me. And I thought that was very interesting. In an 80% Black city, and a majority of the protesters were white. Now, on one end, as I reported, I thought that was very interesting and striking. And from a personal level, being so intimate with the city, I thought that was helpful. But the destructive nature, at least in the early couple of days in the evening, struck me as very odd. And after that, I'll be honest with you, from a personal standpoint, I was enraged. You know, what happens a lot of times in Michigan and happens in Detroit, there's a lot of back and forth about, you know, the Black city versus the out county suburbs. And I thought that there was an element, I wrote about it and tweeted about it, I thought there was an element of white privilege, quite frankly, that was being carried out by some of the protesters who happened to be white, particularly in the evening. Privilege, white privilege, what I mean by that is I'll come and march in your town if I want to and be violent and destructive if I want to, because after all, I'm white. And this African-American Detroiter, native Detroiter, was very, very upset about that.
Kat, are there stories and voices that you see still missing from coverage of the protests right now?
That's a great question. I think that's something that we should always be thinking about. And that's something that I've been kind of mulling over this weekend. You know, we've had all of the spot stories that we've been pushing out, but I feel like we're reaching that moment where journalists, we should really be taking a step back and trying to develop some bigger pieces to really dive into, again, the feelings, the emotions, that very valid feelings that communities have. You know, I had a story just yesterday looking at how there's a growing movement of people that are pushing for police departments across the nation to not just be defunded, but to dismantle them altogether. And a couple years ago, if someone would have said that, people would have said, oh, that's radical, that's nonsense. But what I'm hearing on the ground, there's a lot of movement around it, a lot of conversation about, is this possible? So when I think about stories to pay attention to, that comes to the top of mind. What also comes to the top of mind is 2020. How are people feeling about this? Is this going to impact voter turnout? One person that I spoke with, an activist in Minnesota, she basically said she does not participate in this political system. She does not see Black folks' liberation through the electoral process as it stands. And for me, that's truly stunning. And I think we need to pay attention to this momentum on the ground as we're starting to hear more feelings of people about how they're feeling about Trump, President Trump, Joe Biden, and other issues as well.
If I could say, I mean, I think that Kat hit that spot on. I mean,
Look, I get up every morning and post 5 or 10 things, notable achievements that have happened, centering on Black America or, you know, related to Black America. You know, what I found in my nearly 30 years of reporting and analysis is that white folk pay attention to Black folk when it's February or in times of crisis. Black folk don't even exist. I think what needs to happen is just what Kat's talking about, but we need to do it 24/7, 365 days a year, and not wait for February or times of crisis to recognize Black folk, and I extend that to brown folk and others as well, who happen to be, quote, minorities in America. That's the way forward.
A lot of mental health professionals have been recommending that folks take a break from the news every once in a while. But as Kat alluded to, this is a very difficult time in which to be doing that. How do you both take care of yourself when you have to be covering these events? Kat, how's that working for you? What do you try to work in to keep yourself sane?
Well, first, I try to make sure that my circle is tight. And what I mean by that is that I have mentors to lean on. I have other Black journalists, as well as some journalists of color, who I could lean on and just share some raw thoughts with them, thoughts that you can't exactly share on social media, right? So that first step is important. And also just finding small moments to breathe. It's easy to become overwhelmed. But for me, I have also found strength in this moment because I feel as if there is not a single topic that I would rather be covering in this moment right now than race in America. I can't think of anything that's more important to cover in this moment than race in America. So for me, just knowing that the stories that I and others are reporting and publishing in this moment, that they are helping bring perspective, much needed perspective and truth to this moment, for me, that motivates me to keep pushing forward. But I will say I'm looking forward to after November, where I could actually take a week off.
frequent listeners to the show will remember this is kind of a new job for you, Kat. I mean, I cannot think of a more auspicious entry onto a what turned out to be one of the breaking news stories of the year.
Yeah, you know, I hit the campaign trail in March and then COVID-19 hit. So it's just been a crazy time to start a new role. But again, I couldn't imagine anything else I would rather be covering in this moment.
Ken, how are you taking care of yourself?
I do a lot of reading and research, and I've always done that. I'm reading a lot about the 50s and the 60s. I'm reading a lot about particularly 1966, 1967, 1968 in America, because there's so many parallels that are being drawn to what's happening here in 2020 to those particular 3 years. And I'm finding some similarities and some differences. But secondly, in addition to that, I'm a runner. I run 2 miles every day. It's a little bit tougher to run it with PPE on and a mask and gloves. But I'm very serious about social distancing, even in covering these protests. I'm very much concerned about what these protests might yield in 2 or 3 months with related to COVID spread. But the running is therapeutic. It helps me, obviously, to try to be as physically fit as I can, but it also helps me to think. And so reading and researching about events 50 years ago and getting out and running 2 miles is how I get through it.
As we've said several times today, the deaths of unarmed Black people at the hands of police is not something new. We don't know what's going to happen this time around, but there's been a lot of conversation through the weekend about, you know, again, some of these issues like why is this happening now? What is the confluence of events over the past decade that got us here? As we finish up, I wanted to ask you both what the role of journalism is after the big displays. Not to suggest, I mean, it doesn't feel like things are exactly slowing down, but I don't know, Ken, how do you answer that question?
Well, I think, again, we have to be consistent. I mean, journalism is like a lot of industry in America. It's copycat. It's what's hot now. It's what's trending. I think we have to cover people of color, blacks, browns, and others every day moving forward, the way that we're covering them now. And again, I point out that, you know, I've been in the business 30 years, and I've seen a couple different cycles. And I've seen where this stuff has been hot and sexy. I've seen where newsrooms have ramped up and hired two or three more black people or brown people based on what they see the 6 month or 1 year trend. But what's going to happen if these protests dissipate? And that's the major thing for me. We need to stay consistent. This is a country that's becoming browner, blacker and browner every day of the week. And will the journalism community rise to the occasion and represent that continually is my ask and what I believe their charge should be.
Kat, what do you say?
Well, for starters, just this morning I tweeted, racism is not a both sides issue. And what I mean by that is I really hope that this is the start of journalists and newsrooms across the country really examining what we mean when we say objectivity. Because I think we need to start not just there. I think we also need to take a look at when you do have black folks in the newsroom and you do have journalists of color in the newsroom, what are their assignments? What are they covering? It's not enough to just hire us. We need to be given opportunities to ascend into these management roles, to help guide coverage decisions. And I hope, going along the lines of what Ken said, that this doesn't disappear. We need to be intentional about who we're interviewing, the stories that we cover, because, you know, people are being caught off guard right now. People are shocked about the outrage. But I say, if you are in these communities, if you are doing the due diligence in terms of building connections and talking to folks on the ground, you would not be that surprised to see people in the streets protesting. So I think we need to take a hard look at the industry that we are in and not just form diversity and inclusion committees to look at the problem. We know what the problem is. What is the tangible action we're going to take? That's what I want to see.
Kat, that's a really interesting point you raise about how racism is covered. It feels like it's really informed by politics coverage, which says, you know, which tends to cast things in the role of, well, some people believe this way and other people believe this way. But what are other models that come to your mind when we think about how we cast racism and institutional racism?
So I interviewed an expert. Her name is Rihanna Anderson. She is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan who studies racism and how it pretty much intersects with public health. And she told me that it is past time for America to consider racism a public health hazard. It is time to consider police brutality that black and brown people experience at the hands of police as a public health hazard. Only then, she believes, will we start to see some real coalition behind this notion that it is not just an isolated event that occurs. Racism is deeply embedded in the fabric of this nation, and I don't think that is something that we have truly begin to reckon with. So until we have that honest conversation as a nation, looking at how racism has deeply impacted Black Americans, how it has led to a lot of these oppressive institutions that we have, we will never truly solve it.
It almost sounds like, I hesitate to mention because scientific model has not always done right by communities of color, but it almost sounds like we just need to be more scientific about it.
I think so. And it's a complicated topic, but it's also not as complicated as people make it. Racism is bad. Racism is not a both sides issue. And until people truly understand that and get behind that, I feel as if we're going to keep having the same conversations over and over again. We're going to continuously see these crises impacting Black folks, whether it's the Great Recession, whether it's Hurricane Katrina. You can go down the list and look at all of these recent crises that have occurred in America and who has been hit the hardest. It shows us that we have yet to deal with racism in this country.
Kat Stafford reports for the Associated Press, covering issues on race and ethnicity. We've also been talking with Michigan Advance writer Ken Coleman. He's also a published author on several books addressing history and Detroit history. Ken, Kat, please stay safe out there. We really, really appreciate the work that you're doing right now.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.